Hi. It's so good to see some of your faces. I can't even tell you. It's so nice to see you. Beautiful. You do know this is our first time having the refuges and precepts in this place. And so there is a bit of excitement here. A bit of excitement. Best way to have a ceremony is with a bit of excitement. So, I want to welcome everybody here. See if there's anyone here for the first time at Seattle Insight. It's either me or I'm losing battery juice every couple of seconds here, but let's see if there's anyone in the hall. This is their first time. Oh, well, good to see you all the way in the back, but that's great. What about online? Is there anyone here that's online? This is their first time. I don't see any hands lifted. Well, there you see some hands? Oh, great. There's some hands there. Good. We're so happy to see you. Tonight we're going to have a ceremony. It's kind of special. We kind of set our North Star and move into the year. It's special. And so we're going to start with a sit. I'll give some instruction. And hopefully the mic will hold together. And then we'll have I'll do the meditation. And, we have another mic coming. Good. All right. We'll try this one then. Tim and Carrie will have a little Dhamma talk. And then we'll have our ceremony. And, you know, just keep on going. Set this year in motion. All right.
I feel the excitement that Tuere was mentioning. It was also flashing on a year ago when we were sitting upstairs doing the ceremony at the beginning of last year, and we were so close together. We were almost on top of each other. So I'm very much appreciating that we have a bit more physical space. We also have a space that is increasingly ours, that we're landing in, that we're settling in, that we can practice the Dhamma together, share the Dhamma together. So I feel a sense of buoyancy and excitement about the time ahead. As we move into the ceremony tonight, the ritual, I'll talk a little bit about the refuges, and Tim will say a little bit about the precepts, and then we'll move into the ritual part of the evening. As many of you know, often at the beginning of times of practice, like retreats, or even at the beginning of a day, at the beginning of events, people will take the refuges and precepts together. And we can chant them, we can reflect on them, we can remember them. The refuges in particular, I think of as ways of orienting our heart minds to practice in a direct and intentional, deliberate way. And this is also something that connects us to a lineage of practitioners, of spiritual seekers who've been doing this throughout for millennia now. So it has a very strong, can have a very strong connection to a lineage of practitioners, people engaged in the same activities that we're engaged in right now as we speak. This sense of refuge is also something that implies that there's a sense of safety and trust, that there's something that we can turn towards that will contain us or hold us or give us a wider sense that we can relax into, that we can step back into, orient towards. So it has a wonderful, can have a wonderful sense of safety and holding as well. So traditionally, the three refuges are also talked about as three jewels. So something valuable, not easily tarnished, and radiant. Right? So three refuges are also three jewels that are powerful in that they have the capacity to shine out. But also, they're not flimsy. They're not easily tarnished. So, in my household, we have this saying: "No matter what." So, when we're saying with my son and my husband, I love you. I wish you well. No matter what, NMW. Right? We say NMW. We write that on everything. So our love is not conditional. I don't love you just because you did well in school or just because you behaved the way I thought you should. It's no matter what. So the refuges are powerful and they're a sense of safety because they're there no matter what. So traditionally, they're the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And the outer representations of each of those are meant to evoke or remind us of an inner capacity that we have. And they're meant to do it, I think, in an immediate way. So a direct way. It's not a refuge. I can't remember who said this, but this always occurs to me. It's not a refuge if you can't find it. You have to be able to maybe increasingly and with more directness and clarity, you have to be able to find it. So the Buddha, when we see images of the Buddha, we remember that human being, the Buddha, it is meant to remind us here and now of our capacity to awaken. Of awareness that is present right here and now in this moment. So this early Buddhist tradition is wonderful in that it emphasizes the very humanness of the Buddha. Right? That the Buddha was a human being with sometimes with stomach problems and back pain, with disgruntled relatives, with an aging body, and within those very limitations was able to awaken, use this capacity for awareness to awaken his own heart and mind, to transform his own heart and mind. So when we take refuge in the Buddha, we're remembering that example, but we're also contacting that immediate capacity that we each have to awaken. This capacity for awareness present right here, right now, no matter what. The Dhamma, the outward kind of representation, is in the form of the Buddhist teachings, this extraordinary path and compilation of an incredibly inspiring and wise teachings that is meant to come alive within us, a path that is meant to come alive within us and awaken us to the nature of how things actually are in the moment. So another word for Dhamma is nature. How is it actually in this moment? So the teachings all point towards something that is natural, present here and now, that awareness can know. So when we take refuge in the Dhamma, we're not taking refuge because things turned out how we wanted them to. We're not taking refuge in pleasant experiences, though those may come and go. We're taking refuge in the nature of things as they actually are. And the third is the Sangha, So take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And the Sangha helps remind us that we take on the path individually with our own unique circumstances and tendencies, but we are never alone on that path. So this, I was remembering as I was driving here that my very first talk at Seattle Insight, I don't even remember what the year was, around 2007, something like that, 2008, something, was on refuge in Sangha. And for many of us, this is the refuge and the jewel that we come to know most directly first, yeah, is by feeling, when I walk into this room, I can just be here as I am, no matter what. Right? So we feel that we are in the company of other practitioners. We may not always agree with, we may not always like, but we are on this path together. So hopefully, even just coming into this room tonight, you have somewhat an immediate sense of I'm in Sangha. Right? There's something different about the refuge of Sangha, walking into a space that hopefully increasingly will feel like a refuge. As I said at the beginning, this also connects us to the long lineage of people that have come before us. None of us are here just under our own steam. We're here on the shoulders of all of those people who've come before us in this early Buddhist tradition and in all of the traditions that you might practice in and are a part of. All of your ancestors are a part of your Sangha as well, a part of our Sangha as well. So taking refuge, hopefully, has both this vast quality, this wide quality, this timeless quality, and a very immediate quality. Yeah, this is an orientation for this moment, a sense of safety, opening, depth in this moment. So I am very much looking forward to widening and deepening our sense of refuge together this year and beyond. So, thank you.
All right, good evening. Welcome, everyone. Nice to see all the familiar faces and people I haven't seen for a while and all the new ones. My name is Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers along Tori and Carrie here at Seattle Insight. So this annual ceremony, we link the precepts and the refuges together. So Carrie explained and explored the refuges in a really beautiful way. And you can almost look at the precepts as a way that we take refuge within our own actions, that we actually relate to other people, how we keep ourselves in a state of integrity, and a sense of non-harm to those around us, including ourselves. This last year, if you journeyed with us through the Paramis, we explored the precepts in different ways, sometimes very overtly, sometimes more that kind of the positive expression like generosity. And so it feels like a very alive process around these precepts. The five precepts, which we'll be taking in a little bit, form the foundation of our practice. The foundational piece that allows our practice to start to grow and to develop. Think of it like a foundation for a building. If that foundation is very solid and well rooted into the earth, the building that grows on top of it can be very solid also. Same thing too with our practice. If we may have these aspirations and the philosophy and these meditative states, but if we don't have the foundation of ethics underneath that to support that, it's a little bit shaky. Or maybe we have one of those precepts really solid, or a couple of them. But maybe one we kind of avoid feeling for working with for a while because of different reasons. But luckily, unlike a house, we can actually work on the precepts as we were practicing all along. In fact, sometimes that allows us to have a deeper understanding of each of the precepts. Because as we practice, we gain this understanding of our own inner experience. We become more sensitive to that dissonance. We start to notice our motivations, how sometimes they're mixed. Our intentions of harm sometimes come out. And we start to catch that more and more easily. Right? This becomes, again, a way of really safeguarding our own actions. Because we're become more and more honest with ourselves, honest with our own intentions, and also to start to develop this capacity to really receive the impact of our actions when we do cause harm. So the practice starts to inform our understanding, and understanding helps to strengthen our commitment to the precepts. Now this year we'll be talking about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And you can see in the circular nature of the Eightfold Path that the precepts are kind of the middle section, how we actually show up ethically in the world, how we show up in the place of virtue. And it's interesting that sandwiching, because the first part of the Eightfold Path is around developing your intentionality and your understanding of what causes harm, what causes suffering, what causes the release of that. Then from that place, that flows into our actions. And then after that comes our practices of cultivation, of mindfulness, of concentration, which allow us to have deeper perceptions, which then in turn allows us to understand wisdom more clearly, which then leads back to the precepts. So it's a beautiful time to explore that in this later part of this year, the Eightfold Path. At this time in the year, the beginning, we always like to take the precepts as a community, that we all are on the same page of honoring these basic, in some ways you can think of as agreements with ourselves to not cause harm, agreements with those around us that we'll do the best we can not to cause harm. Now, as you contemplate these precepts, I'll go through each of them briefly here, and then as we chant them in a more formal way, bring a renewed sense of commitment and engagement around them. Some of you maybe have never heard of the precepts. Other of you have heard them for decades. And sometimes when you've heard a lot, it becomes a little bit of an autopilot. You just kind of, okay, there's the precepts, I'm going to chant. But I encourage us to bring extra energy to them, particularly notice which of the precepts we feel maybe a little bit shy or embarrassed about some of our actions, the way we perhaps tell little lies, or perhaps how we, steal things when we probably don't really need to become more aware of that. So whatever experience level you have, bring that alive commitment to that exploration of these precepts. And that way we can start to make the precepts actually a place of growth and learning. Ideally, we're able to catch our actions before we actually act. We see the intentionality. Okay, that intention is coming from a place of closed-heartedness, of scarcity, of anger, of greed, of hatred. And then that's going to tend to lead to something that's unperceptual, that's against these precepts. And we can catch it and change it. Other times we catch it after the fact. Sometimes I find myself telling a lie for no particular reason other than maybe I'm embarrassed about something or I just don't want to share something. And after the fact, I can work with that reality. I can work with the fact that I told something that wasn't true. To bring that into a sense of almost after the fact, really bringing investigation and understanding to bear, to see in a more clear way what was there. So we can do this, we can hopefully do this exploration in low stakes ways. Notice the little ways we bump up against them, but maybe sometimes we have to do that when we have more severe consequences. Maybe we're sitting in prison and trying to reflect on how we broke that precept. But it can still all be all part of your learning. I know no one in this sangha that I know that's been there, has had that happen. But even if you have, it can still be a learning. Because we carry so much shame around ourselves. Like, okay, I've broken that precept. I caused harm in this way. If we get caught in the shame of it, we don't have a chance to actually learn about it. Bring a quality of curiosity. What's it like? What was it like? What was my worldview that led me to act in this way? Bring compassion along with that also. Compassion for your actions. Compassion of how maybe you caused harm because you were feeling hurt yourself. Now, all these precepts are phrased, we can phrase them in kind of not stealing, not harming, not killing. We can also frame them in a more positive way, like not generosity versus not stealing. And what the precepts that we'll be reading, I believe, have both translations, which I'll share. And each of these precepts begin with the phrase, I undertake the training to refrain from. I undertake the training to refrain from. This is in contrast to some other traditions that have like the shalt not kind of phrasing, right? And for me, that it brings me more this permission to open and to see my own edges, to realize I do have those shadow parts of me which are very happy to break the precepts at times, and to not deny those, but actually bring that into the light, to become more and more aware of those. And in that awareness, that actually safeguards my actions in a much deeper way. So the precepts are tend to come from inside versus from outside. They're not like this external imposition upon you, but how we learn from our own understanding. So the precepts actually help decrease our suffering. They decrease our suffering in a very clear, direct way. They help other people have less suffering, right? This is something, if you pay attention, you see this. You see the internal churning when you tell a lie or steal something. You feel the open-heartedness of being aligned with what's true and speaking that, being aligned with generosity and how the heart opens and relaxes. So these precepts, just to touch upon them, and again, we'll chant them in a few minutes here. So the first one is understanding how intertwined we are. I undertake the training to refrain from killing. I vow to cultivate compassion toward all beings. So this non-killing, non-harming, cultivating compassion toward all beings, coming from a place of understanding the interconnection, right? So playing with this on the subtle ways that it shows up, how we maybe kill an insect without even pausing to recognize that we're taking a life, that creature was just trying to make its way in the world, you know, to reflect upon that and see if there's other options. And this one I always like to include more subtle ways of harm, how we cause harm toward ourselves and toward others. Because killing is kind of it's a extreme action of harm. You know, and harm can take so many different shapes. But a lot of it is just this denial of this other person's life, this other person's experience, and turning that inward also. How much do we deny our own experience? How much do we judge ourselves so harshly? So trying to see that from a framework of working with the precepts. The next one is understanding how intertwined we are. I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. Our vow to practice generosity. Right? So we've got both the not stealing part and also the practice of generosity. For those who worked with the Paramis back in, what was it, March, I guess, was that one?
No, it was January.
It was January?
Number one.
Generosity, yes, right. So the very first one. You know, that this is a very rich practice, is how do we explore generosity, how do we explore that sense of giving and receiving, and also the edge of, okay, how can I not steal? For me, this often feels I can see that little sense of, oh, no one would notice if I took this, or no one would notice if I did this little act of theft. And yet I would know. And as I choose not to act on that, there's a way that my system settles, my heart settles, my heart opens. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from sexual harm. I vow to cultivate responsibility. Okay, so sexual harm, this is such an important thing to bring to the forefront, to realize that our sexuality, which is is a human drive, it's a human way. I mean, we're all here because someone was sexual in our past, right? Our parents were sexual at least once. And sometimes even more than once. So how can we bring that sense of really, you know, honoring the other person, delighting that person, having a real clear sense of consent? Is the consent really, is it equal partners? If there's a power differential, the consent's always going to be a little on shaky ground. You know, there's that sense of really honoring the person, seeing the person as a human being who is also a sexual partner instead of just that aspect. And of course, there's all the very painful ways that we experience harm through misuse of sexuality, through abuse, through assault, that unfortunately many of us have experienced. So cultivating that sense of responsibility around sexual energy and our sexual lives and interactions. The fourth one is understanding how intertwined we are. I undertake the training to refrain from harmful speech. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening. So harmful speech, and also sometimes this one's held as not speaking a falsehood, not lying. And this one there's that edge of how do I know, when do I say something that's really not true? Often we know when we cross that threshold. Sometimes we cross it because we're insecure or we're embarrassed about saying something or we're trying to hide something. That's a great rich area of practice to bring that forth. You know, can I bring forth non-harm in my speech? And the final precept is understanding how intertwined we are. I undertake the training to refrain from intoxication, which leads to carelessness. I vow to consume items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy. For this precept, when we do become intoxicated to the point of we become heedless, we become careless in our actions, all the precepts are easy to break. Or we can cause harm, we can kill, we can misuse our sexual energy, we can steal, we can tell lies. So it all kind of flows from that level of intoxication. Right? So it's held in different ways in this culture, or you know, especially this kind of Western Buddhist culture. I myself tend to hold it that it's okay to enjoy some substances, but to also be aware when you start to become heedless and to really be aware if you cross that threshold, can you make sure you protect yourself and those around you? Can you have, you know, have a designated driver, for example, and all those other ways that plays out. And of course, if we do struggle with this one, if there's addictions, and many in the room have also gone through recovery and they know how deeply that work can be as you start to struggle and really learn yourself about yourself in a very deep way. So these five precepts, as we take them as a community, feel that sense of integrity, how it allows our community to become more and more connected. There's a way that we can relax more and more into those refuges of Sangha, of the Buddha, of the Dharma. All right, thank you for your kind attention.
So we're about to enter this ceremony. A little thing about ceremonies. They kind of represent not where we're at, but where it's like a felt sense in the present moment of a place we're going in the future. So it's sort of like when you're on a hike and you're feeling yourself on the hike as you're walking up the mountain, you feel the present moment, but you're actually moving towards. your lunch spot. Where? That's where you're really going, is where we're going to stop and eat lunch. So we're kind of moving towards where we're going to eat lunch, you know, where we're going to, you know, just sit and turn around and go back down the hill. And so what you want along the way is something to help you remember where you're at, something that's going to help you connect to staying where you are and not constantly doing what I do, which is thinking about everything I brought for lunch. My friends used to make fun of me because when I would go on hikes and the first time I ever went with them, they said, oh, we're going to stop and have lunch at the top of the mountain. So when I think about lunch, I think about soup and a sandwich, and I'd have a feast and a little like cloth so I can put it down so that I'm not just eating on dirt or something. And they used to laugh because I had a full-on lunch, and all I would do is think about what I was going to eat. So in a way, we need something that keeps us here, now, where we're at. And so that's what this yarn is for. It's like the monk's robes is what they say. It's like you take a slight string or thread from a monk's or a nun's robe, and you carry that with you to remind you about the practice. And so here we are carrying this thread that's all come from the same yarn. It's just been cut for each of us to carry each other with us as a reminder. And so what we're going to do is put four knots in this yarn. Even at home, whatever string you have, we're going to put four knots in it. And I'm going to tell you what those knots to be in just a moment. So think for a moment what Carrie was saying. How are you going to find safety in the Buddha this year? How are you going to find that? How are you going to remember that there is a refuge possible in the Buddha? Take a moment and think about it. I mean, really, for you, not me. I have a way to find a refuge with Buddha. We have a serious relationship. We've been together for a while now. But you, how will you, in the midst of some difficulty, find a sense of refuge in the Buddha? Think about that. And when you seem to have a clarity of how you think you could find him, or how you could find the Buddha within you, then tie your knot. All right, so now we need to get a connection with the Dhamma. Dhamma as a refuge, you know, it means seeing some things, like Tim is pointing out, seeing some things that maybe we don't want to see. Maybe seeing some things or feeling some things or being in situations, having to face where we currently are, when we may not want to. So how can you find refuge in being with the difficulties that are going to show up inevitably in this year? How can you show up for the difficulties, and how can you show up for the joys that will fall away? How can we let our joys go? Because they will come this year and they will fall away. And how can we be with the sorrows and the difficulties in a way that keeps us tied to the Dhamma? And think about that for you. What would you need to do to help you stay connected or stay with the Dhamma through it all, no matter what? What do you need? And then when you're ready, put your knot in your cord, in your monk or nun or nun's robe. Just a little thread. Okay. And then lastly, you know how you feel right now in this room? You know, we could pretty much take on anything in this room together with this crowd, right? Online, you see how you are. You see the room, how you feel right now. How can you stay engaged with Sangha? Because somehow it's in our relationship with each other. You are not the only one practicing with difficulty. Everyone in this room is. We want to. We are actually trying to find some dukkha. All year we're going to be looking for dukkha. Difficulty. The dissatisfaction of life. In every sit at Seattle Insight, for the entire year, we are all going to talk about finding our way through this dissatisfying world, dissatisfying life of being human, and we want to. So how are you going to stay connected with Sangha in a way that will help you do this? And then when you feel you have a connection here, then you can tie a knot to remind yourself, this is what I'm going to do to stay connected. All right. In my whole practice life, I used to watch teachers. And I used to always believe, I know they got some kind of secret teaching that they haven't told us. There's something else. It can't be just, you know, watch the breath. There's something they haven't told us. So I finally find my way to Philip Moffat. He's about the most mystic teacher I've ever known in my life. He is a walking mystic. And I would ask him over and over and over, Philip, come on, tell me the secret teaching. What's the hidden thing, you know, that gets you there quicker? And he, one time we were sitting talking about how to live more within your practice, the way you want to live within your practice. And he said, it's your North Star. You have to have one, and you have to carry it with you, your North Star. Now, somewhere in this practice, from the moment you stepped on the path, from the moment you got connected, you read something, somebody told you about meditation, you came to some class, however it was, you heard some podcast, the moment that you found your way on this path, it set in motion a North Star. And sometimes we forget what that is. But just take a moment and think about it. What's the North Star that brought you to this path? What's the thing that has kept you here? And remind yourself by putting a knot in your cord. This is the thing. This is your actual secret teaching. Because as long as you remember the thing that brought you here, you will stay on the path, come what may. What's your North Star? And now we want to turn to someone close to us. And thankfully, Tim actually made them long enough. So you could even put them on as a necklace if you want to. Not the little short ones that we used to have to put tied around our fingers. Okay, it wasn't that bad. But turn to someone close to you. If you're at home and you have someone in your household, you're welcome to ask them to tie it on you, or you can wrap it around and save it for a moment, maybe tie it on your ankle, and then tie it when you can if you're at home. Doing okay? Everybody tied? Everybody's all protected, ready? Good, good. So Ken is going to put up the slides for the chanting. We're going to chant this together. I want to tell you a little bit about this chanting. So the first part, for those of you that have never chanted this, first part is a homage to the Buddha. It's a homage, I think, to the idea that a human took the time to awaken, took the time and actually found the path and awakened. And so we give a homage to him. We'll say the Namo Tassa is what it's called in Pali. I'll do it in a call and response, but we won't say the English on that. And then we will do the Pali for the refuges. You can read what it is. You can read what it is in English, but we will say it as a call and response. I think it's pretty simple what we're saying there. And then we'll do the precepts. And the way we'll do the precepts, we'll do a call and response on the Pali. And then we'll say the English right immediately after that together. All right? All right. So you can put your hands in prayer pose. You can put your hands on your heart or not. Either way, it's fine. Namo Tassa, Namo Tassa, Bhagavato Arahato, Bhagavato Arahato, Samma Sambuddhasa, Samma Sambuddhasa, Namo Tassa, Namo Tassa, Bhagavato Arahato, Bhagavato Arahato, Samma Sambuddhasa, Sama Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa Sama Sambuddhasa Buddham Saranam Gacchami Buddham Saranam Gacchami Dhammam Saranam Gacchami Dhammam Saranam Gacchami Sangham Saranam Gacchami Sangham Saranam Gacchami Dutiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami Dutiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami Dutiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami Dutiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami Dutiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami Dutiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami Tatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami Tatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami Now the precepts. Panatipata viramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Panatipata viramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Adinadana viramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Adinadana viramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami Kamesu machachara viramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami Kamesu machachara viramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami Sorry, I realize I messed up. We'll just keep going. Musawada viramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami Musawada viramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami I'll break this last one up. Sira Mirya Majapamadattana Majapamadattana viramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami viramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami Let's go up and say the English on all of them. I understand how intertwined we are. I undertake the training to refrain from killing. I vow to cultivate compassion towards all beings. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. I vow to practice generosity. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from sexual harm. I vow to cultivate responsibility. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from harmful speech. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from intoxication, which leads to carelessness. I vow to consume items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy. Idam me silam. Idam me silam magapala nyatasa magapala nyatasa pachayo ho tu May my conduct be the condition for the attainment of the highest fruits of liberation. Together, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you so, so much. So much. Didn't it sound great hearing that? Oh my God.
Thank you, Tori, for leading that. Yeah, it's such a lovely experience to hear everyone chanting, taking that commitment together. So we thought we'd just share a few words, you know, different topics for each of us. And I wanted to just do a quick kind of review of last year and what kind of highlights that came forth to my mind. One of the biggest ones is that we inhabited this physical location. It was about a 2.5 year process of working with the city and getting permits and working with a contractor. And finally, it came to fruition in June. And since then, we've been fully inhabiting it, doing evening classes, doing day-longs, doing retreats. And for many years in the future, hopefully this will continue to be our home. So thanks for all of those who helped make that possible. Another thing that happened is we did a year-long training for what we call local Dharma leaders. So these are students who've been practicing diligently, have a good maturity of practice, and then we wanted them to start to be able to share the Dharma in you know, different ways, sometimes leading talks, or day-long, sometimes doing interviews. There's a wide range of ways that shows up. And I just want to honor those people who went through that process, and I want to actually read their names. And if you're here in person, you don't mind standing up, that would be lovely. And if you're online, you could, I don't know what you could do. You could raise your hand and jump up and down or something.
Raise your mechanical hand.
Yeah. Raise your mechanical hand. But they could do one of those reactions with all the,
that's right.
The sparkly things. And I apologize in advance. I have some dyslexia, so sometimes I mangle last names. So I apologize. So we had Judith Evinger, who's up in Bellingham. We have Khalid Alazar. This is alphabetical names by the last name. We had Jean Canning, Adam Curry, Gisli Garcia, Nana Jaisley, Sean Holmes. We had Nina LeBoy, Tamira Littal, Cheryl Marlin, there in the back, Joyce Mickelson, Takaki Okada, who I saw online, Candace Robb, Vivian Sue, and last but not least, Valerie Tron. Yeah, so we met monthly. We talked about different elements around teaching, around boundaries, around holding space, and you can see those online. And this is, it's interesting. We have people who don't live here in Seattle. We have Tamira, who's in Hood River, and we have Vivian, yeah, Tataki, who lives in Portland, and Judith, who lives up in Bellingham. And so we have a nice range of kind of including the online Sangha. We also, of those people, a few of them also got accepted into the local or to the CDL program, Community Dharma Program, the leader program. This is a 2.5 year process through Spirit Rock, a very well-respected training. And so the three people we have, Sean, who's standing up, Sean Holmes. We have Nana and Gisli and Vivian. So we're looking forward to their additional training and deepening into the Sangha. And then we also have another person who's, we're going to start to bring more and more into the Sangha, Fern Marie Rodriguez, if you mind standing up. So she got accepted into the four-year teacher training combined with IMS and Spirit Rock. So this is training her to become a retreat teacher. And so we're hoping to have her more and more involved here at Seattle Insight. And Tweri is one of the lead teachers of that program. And then finally, another really important announcement is that we kind of been doing this a little bit de facto, but finally, Carrie Peterson has become, the board invited her to be a guiding teacher here at Seattle Insight. Yeah. So Carrie's been involved with Seattle Insight for decades, and Tweri and I are very happy to have her join the council. All right, so thank you, and thank you for all your dedication, and we're looking forward to how this year will evolve and reveal itself.
Right. Thank you, Tim, and really want to applaud and thank the dedication for the people who've gone through the local Dharma leader training and are committed enough to practice in Seattle Insight to continue on. So it feels like such an exciting time for our Sangha. It feels like an auspicious time for the Dhamma in the Northwest in general. So I know when we started practicing a long time ago, it was still kind of a weird thing to do, and took a little explaining, and not a lot of my peers at the time were heading in that direction. And now there's so much interest and enthusiasm and evidence and research about the benefits of these practices. So it feels like a wonderful time to be practicing and to be able to offer this physical space as a practice center and a refuge. Physical and online space, hybrid space. So big bows to the AV volunteers who have been the most instrumental during the pandemic, during this quite clunky transition. But I just feel this renewed, like we have the Sangha has very deep roots in this area. We've been around for a long time. We have deep connections to a wider Dharma community, family, and we've weathered some storms over the past few years, pandemic and many moves and challenges. And now it really feels like a time of kind of extending our branches. So, yeah, lots of ideas, which I'll try to not go into tonight, but just to convey Tim's like, don't tell all of your ideas. so just talk about how you're excited. Yeah, so more to just carry this this spirit. Like we're all drawn together in this place with a particular vision, however articulated and concrete that might be. That is important. That is important. Tweri was mentioning that as well. So my wish, and I know many of us share it, is that this place be a deepening refuge and place of practice for many people in many different ways. So we'll be able to continue to offer what we're offering. We have several visiting teachers from around the country coming this year. The local Dharma leaders will be offering day-long retreats, so we'll have more times for extended practice during the day. Yeah, There's a lot happening. So I encourage you to get involved in ways that feel right to you, and to come and hopefully be nourished and inspired. Yeah, so may this continue to be a refuge, place of practice, and encouragement for many. Thank you.
I want to just mention the board, too. This is also a big part of the leadership here at Seattle Insight. So those here in the room, we got Cubba. Reese, could you stand up? She's the board president. We have David Regalville, if you could stand up, in charge of programs, program director. And let's see, who else? And any other board members in the room? See, online, we have Judith, who is the communications director. And we have Gisli, who's charge of the venues, and Nana, who's in volunteer lead or volunteer director, and May, who's the treasurer. Did I get everyone? Oh, Stephen, who's our secretary. So thank you all for they do a lot of work behind the scenes to keep things going. So thank you so much for your service to the Sangha.
So I want to say that Carrie, you know how, I'll describe it like this. I know it's good to drink water, but one day Tim and I were busting down some cabinet in that room, getting it ready for the walking space. And if you haven't been back there in that north room, please go back there after this sit so you can see how we can have daylongs, a place to eat. And it used to be grimy back there. And so Tim, I, and Steve were busting down this cabinet that somebody put together. And, oh, it was so difficult. And all of a sudden, I just couldn't do any more work. I was so tired. I'm like, I can't do any more. I'm done. And Tim hands me this bottle of water and said, here, try some water. Maybe that'll help. And I'm thinking, water is not going to help me. I'm tired. But I drank that water. It was like renewed my spirit. That's what Carrie does. Carrie renewed our spirit because, you know, Tim and I have been holding Seattle Insight for a while now, and going through all of this and putting everything together and keeping this Sangha together through the pandemic and everything, we were becoming weary, like trying to bust down that cabinet. And then, I hate to say it that way, but we were getting weary. And then Carrie comes and she says, idea after idea after idea. And in that, it renews your heart. It renews your spirit. It's sort of like for all of us, for those of you that have been volunteering, then all of a sudden there's a couple more volunteers that show up. It renews your spirit. And you think, I can keep doing this if I have some help. And so that's what Carrie is. And I am eternally grateful that she joined us up here. It's very nice. I'm eternally grateful for all the volunteers, for all the Donna that you offer us, all of that. And so this year might seem like we are going into the depths of hell because we're going to talk about dukkha all year. But actually, that is not what the Four Noble Truths are. The Four Noble Truths, when the Buddha said, I come to teach one thing, dukkha and the end of dukkha, suffering and the end of suffering. It is because we don't always see this, but the moment suffering arises, in that moment is also the opportunity to be free from that suffering. But mostly we don't see the freedom that's possible because we're so busy trying to fix, get rid of, or do something about the suffering. And if we learn to be still, then we can see this natural capacity for the end of suffering. And do you know why? Because the Buddha saw that it didn't matter what it was, whatever arises passes away. That's it. There's nothing else. Whatever arises will end. And beginning to see that in reality, that you don't have to do something to make it end, it will end. It may not end when you want it to end, but it will end. Everything. So every good thing that comes your way will end. Every difficulty that comes our way will end. Everything that arises, it's conditional. And when those conditions change, it is no more. So learning to see that is what's difficult. That's where the difficulty lies. And that's what we're going to look at this year. And we are ready because we have spent a year cultivating a heart from all those paramis, all those different strength mechanisms and capacity building. We have spent a year pulling all that energy together. And the next place to go is the Four Noble Truths. It is the next, it is the point that we have the capacity to look at. So yes, we're going to look at dukkha and its suffering. But we are also going to look at the cause behind that, to begin to see what that is, and to begin to see how to see in this very moment the cessation of that suffering. And then how does the Eightfold Path keep us on our way? How does it help us stay intertwined and connected? This is the Four Noble Truths. It is Buddha's fundamental teaching. So after he got awake, and I don't know if you know, but right before he decided to go out on his own, he ate something, and the people he was practicing with pretty much left him because he blew it. He messed up. And what he did when he practiced is he came to an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So when he became awakened, he walked, I think it's some 200 miles to find those five monks that left him, to find them and tell them what he had uncovered, what he had seen, that he had actually awakened, and he was going to tell them how to do it. And so he left, and he walked and walked and walked until he found them. And when he found them, he shared the Four Noble Truths with them. And in that sharing, what is called the turning of the wheel of Dhamma, it's because in that sharing, when he was with them, first time he's ever shared this Four Noble Truths with someone else, of the five, one of them understood. One of them became awakened. And then there was this realization that not only had he awakened, but that he could articulate the path so that someone else could awaken. And that is, in effect, why Dhamma is held on a wheel, because he turned it in that sharing. And so that's what we're doing here. We are continuing that turning of that wheel so that we can all share it together. It's not something you can easily do by yourself, but together we could do it. And so that's what we are going to look at over the next year in various ways, all the LDLs, all these different sits that we have. There are different people. There are googobs of ways to hear and understand dukkha. And so it's not one thing. It is a vast array of understanding. And usually,
I have a like a board that I've put together that has the whole training laid out. And I cannot believe it, but I totally forgot it. I not forgot the board. I forgot to make it completely. I can't even believe it. I've been doing it for almost 10 years, and I forgot. So we'll have it here next week, and you'll see it. But I hope you'll join us. I hope you'll stay with us and follow us, whether you're online or here in person. But you'll find a sit that we do, one of the meditations we do, and go through this journey with us together. May be a completely different year than what you thought it was going to be. All right. I think I give it back to Tim.
You want to just do your talk about donor
volunteering? Oh, yeah. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about Donna and volunteering. And this Seattle Insight is notorious for being a volunteer organization. It's all volunteers here. We've done it since the beginning. And sometimes I can't believe that we've hung on all these years. But we have, as a volunteer organization. But we have done something a little different now. This space actually takes a lot to keep it going, to keep the events going, and we need people to volunteer for those for that space. And you're going to hear about it. Adam's going to talk a little bit about that in a minute. But it's not, we don't want you to give your whole life over to us. You'll just burn out, and you're not going to be happy, and we're not going to be happy. So we want little tiny jobs that you can do and just kind of be like a drink of water, refresh the moment, help out a little. When you're coming to an event, volunteer, help out as part of the event since you're going to be there anyway. Or if you're online and you can't really get here because you're not even living in the city, there are all kinds of online volunteer things that you can do to support the Sangha as a whole. But basically, we are because you are. And what you give, that's what we are able to do. And if people don't give, it's difficult that whether we can continue with some of the things we'd like to do. The second thing has to do with Donna. And to be honest, for those of you that are longtime Seattle Insight people, I mean, we have an awkward relationship with Donna. It's almost like we don't really tell you that we need support financially, but we do. And now that we have the space and we've extended ourselves, we really need to have enough money to pay the rent and the lights and various support things that we have to do to maintain the space. It's actually quite good. When I think about being a teacher, Tim and Carrie and I, part of Buddha's lineage is to ask for support from the community. And he set it up that way on purpose so that the monastics could not go off somewhere and just do their practice and go into town, get some food, take it with them, and have it there. He set it up in such a way that every day they'd have to go and ask for food. Every day they'd have to have some support from the community. And he set it up that they would become dependent upon the community. So their liberation was dependent on the community. And at the same time, the community was dependent upon the monastic, that whole monastic core who would take the teachings, study the teachings, and then share the teachings with them. And in this symbiotic relationship between the monastic community and the lay community, this Dhamma has been carried for 2,700 years by volunteers and Donna. By volunteers and generosity. That's what Donna is. That is striking to me. And likewise, we do the same thing. It's here, it's through Donna, and it's through volunteerism that we're going to be able to continue and grow and stay as a Sangha that's vibrant and strong for everybody. So there's something I'd like you to consider this year in terms of Donna, because we give Donna, and we give a little here and there, but I'd like you to consider giving a monthly amount to Seattle Insight. I don't care what that monthly amount is, but that you give a monthly amount, and that that amount is what supports us to build a budget and know that we'll be able to pay the rent and be able to pay the lights and things like that. And there won't be that sense of worrying if we're going to make enough, if people show up. So just consider all of you, if everybody in this room gave a small amount every month within their means, then we could know that we would be able to be here for the long haul. And so that's something I think I'd like to just reach out to us for and see if we can do that. And leave your Donna to the teachers is what you give on the individual events that you go to. But that somehow you think of this place as yours, and you pay a small amount, and you trust that everybody else pays a small amount. And together, this place will be secure, and we'll be able to be long into the years, 2,700 years, and we'll still be, maybe not in this building, but there'll still be a Seattle Insight, assuming there's a Seattle. So I really appreciate your care. I really appreciate your support for us. I have one last thing. So online, Cheryl is our wizard, web wizard, and created a page for the year of the Four Noble Truths, and it has resources on it. And the reason why I'm making sure I tell you is that she also created a QR code out in the lobby that you can take a photo of, get your card, and you'll go straight to that page. And on that page is a list of resources. One includes a link to Philip Moffitt's book on Dancing with Life, which is the Four Noble Truths that we're going to go through. But what Philip has done is he has 52 weeks of pointers, practice pointers, that will come to you each week in the mail to keep you kind of engaged with it. And it would be nice to start it this week. Since this is the beginning of the year, you can get that link on that page. And then every week you'll have a little link that will come your way to tell you how to stay engaged in the practice. All right. So that's all I have. You guys have anything else?
Yeah, just a great deep thank you and gratitude for everyone's practice and your continued support of Seattle Insight and of the Dharma.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you. And onward, together. Let's go. No matter what. Yes, yes, yes.